Looking to stand out from the pack at your first job? When you earn a master's in management from Georgetown, you'll gain the skills employers value most, elevating your career prospects for years to come. Get started at choosegeorgetown.com/MIM.
Welcome to the Smart Driving Cars podcast. Thanks for being here with us. I'm Fred Fishkin, along with the faculty chair of autonomous vehicle engineering at Princeton University, Alan Kornhauser. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Fred.
Well, we are really happy to have joining us this week Marjorie Blumenthal, director of the RAND Science, Technology, and Policy Program, and the principal investigator for the just completed Autonomous Vehicle Safety Project. Thanks for being here, Marjorie.
My pleasure.
Great having you.
To start out with, Marjorie, tell us a bit about the background here. The research, we understand, was sponsored by Uber's Advanced Technologies.
That's correct. As you may know, RAND has done a variety of projects looking at autonomous vehicles and policy, and it's looked in broad ways at safety issues as well. In the summer of 2017, the Uber Advanced Technologies people approached us and asked if it would be possible to develop a framework for measuring autonomous vehicle safety that is company and technology neutral. So that was our charge, and that initiated a process that unfolded over basically the last academic year, or our fiscal year, of talking with a wide number of companies, some researchers, safety advocates, government officials, very intellectually diverse group of people, to understand how people think about measuring safety and what were the possibilities for improving the state of the practice.
Let's talk about some of the key findings.
Sure.
Give us the overview.
So we did first discover that there is no consensus way to define safety, which we thought was rather interesting. So for our purposes, we have defined it as the elimination, minimization, or management of harm to the public. And there our emphasis is on people as opposed to animals or property. We developed a framework that you can imagine as a kind of matrix combining stages, settings, and measures. So by stages, we're talking about three stages of producing an autonomous vehicle: development, demonstration, which we are arguing is a set of benchmarking moments that should be formalized, and deployment. And then we looked at three settings for testing during those three stages: simulation, driving on closed courses, and driving on public roads with and without a safety driver. So given a matrix of the stages versus the settings, we looked at the kinds of measures that might be possible in each of those cells. So we looked at what you might call lagging measures, which in some ways are the gold standard. They're just elusive in this space. So a lagging measure would be a safety outcome like crashes, which are uncommon. And that's why most of the measures that people end up talking about are leading measures or proxy measures of driving behaviors that may be correlated with safety outcomes. So infractions would be an example. Would a vehicle have violated a rule of the road? The most common leading measure, and we discussed some of its shortcomings, is disengagement. And so a lot of people are familiar with the California requirement that companies report the number of disengagements. And we, after talking with a number of people in industry, came up with the idea of an integrated measure that we have called roadmanship. We wanted a way to build from behaviors of the vehicle to understand how it would, in essence, play well with others, how it would behave in traffic. So because safety events are so uncommon, where it's not possible to have an exposure-based measure, we also advocated that there be more case studies developed and shared from safety events. And you can see a beginning of that practice in investigation reports when there are incidents, but one could adopt the practice more broadly, especially if companies were willing to share more interesting experiences that they encountered. So overall, you know, we saw that the success of autonomous vehicles requires public trust, and we believe that being a little bit more transparent and consistent in measuring safety would be helpful in fostering public trust. In addition to the framework, we also talked about some other issues. So for example, when people talk about highly automated vehicles, the so-called level 4 vehicles, those operate within an operational design domain, within a set of constraints, geographic, temporal, weather, and so on. Because we have competing companies who are doing things in different ways, there could be value in having a common taxonomy of elements for these operational design domains so that there could be a common way of describing this set of operating constraints, and the public could understand what it means to compare across these operational design domains and understand similarities and differences across vehicles. We also talked about the value of agreeing on common protocols for testing and also for communicating results during the demonstration stage that we advocated. Those are the principal points that we arrived at, other than, in addition, calling for or at least report noting the benefit of having a protocol for information sharing, recognizing that in a highly competitive environment, information sharing is difficult.
Did you get widespread cooperation with this, or were there companies that did not want to participate?
By and large, we were able to communicate with a large number of companies, and we list them all in our acknowledgement. And one of the reasons I think that our approach was successful was that, well, there are two aspects, but the most important aspect may be that we had almost all of these interactions in a one-on-one kind of context. That is, members of the research team talked with individuals from the company in question. So that could be a more comfortable environment in which we could demonstrate that we meant what we said when we set up the conversation in explaining that we weren't looking for anything that was highly proprietary. We were trying to explore how did people think about safety, about measuring safety, about the strengths and weaknesses of different approaches, and we found that people relaxed into the conversation and got interested in it. We did have one group interaction, a small workshop, and that was very helpful, both for the obvious reasons that when you get people together, they mix it up, and you get a fuller sense of the issues, and it helped us to refine our thinking, and actually this notion of roadmanship was something that arose from that workshop conversation, and then we developed it further. But it arose because we were talking about different kinds of measures that have been proposed by people in industry, people in academia. We present a number of these proposals in capsule form in the report, and people were acknowledging both the limitations of individual existing proposed measures and the virtues of having something that was more integrated. So I think we were pleased by the cooperation that we received, and I think it's also a sign that, the industry is maturing to some degree, and there may be some growing recognition that doing more things in common could benefit everybody.
Alan?
I think that in my quick look at your report and your summary, I think it is, of course, excellent. The efforts and the objectives that you have with this, because, of course, safety is an absolute necessary requirement associated with this technology. And it's not going to see the light of day if it's not perceived to be safe. This is an enormously challenging job, maybe unachievable job in some sense, to even, you know, think that one can come up with a quantitative measure or set of quantitative measures that then translates into perceptions such that there is sufficient public trust to allow this technology to advance and provide the benefits that at least many of us see in this technology, the hurdle that has to be achieved on this is that it has to be safe. Again, that is a perceptive measure by the community at large and various elements of that community for that to happen. Some of the things that I guess I wish, one would go farther in, of course, as many people know, you may know also, Marjorie, I just don't like the levels. The levels, if one is trying to not confuse the public, my goodness, the worst way you should start is by talking about levels. It has essentially nothing to do with what is being tried, what one is trying to achieve with these technologies. And importantly, what one is trying to achieve is to achieve mobility in these various domains. And it's very good that you spell out the domains. Those domains, maybe at some, who knows what future, become infinite such that there are no constraints, but all domains are limited. And in fact, what may be safe in one domain is not safe in another domain. And it's very important to first see what it is that one is trying to achieve with this. So if one is trying to provide mobility, let's say to the mobility disadvantaged within a community of whatever that you geofence and so on that has certain conditions, which doesn't include going who knows how many miles an hour down who knows what divided highway, then that part of it, isn't part of it. Or if one is looking to say that, no, it's going to be within an area in which pedestrians are fenced off or whatever, that's a whole other domain. And the tying in of safety with domain from the beginning in terms of what one is trying to achieve, I think has to be an important component. To ask people to go to achieve hurdles in one domain, which is not the domain in which they're operating in, makes no sense. So I think it's very important that you brought the concept of the domain within that. And again, what is it? The measures that we've used, as you pointed out, are not good measures. Anything having to do with just saying VMT, my goodness, that's just wrong. Simply because you can game the system so easily if it were that simple, because there are easy VMTs and there are hard VMTs and there are really tough VMTs. And the other really good things that you point out is really a beginning of a discussion that in fact the industry should be sharing the safety information and how to achieve that while protecting intellectual property and also doing it in a way such that the competition in this industry takes place beyond safety, not with safety, and that the safer everybody can make it together and actually improves everybody's opportunities to be successful is a really important one. As we well know with respect to safety, as you well put it extremely well, it's the leading measures, not the lagging measures. We don't know what we don't know. We don't know what Mother Nature might throw at us that all of a sudden we trip over. And as we trip over those things, all of the information that one gathers from tripping over those things should be available to the community at large, so that in fact everybody can have the opportunity to attack those and address those as best they can. This certainly was partially done with the Uber crash in Arizona, because I guess at least Uber certainly made available at least some of the information that was there. But all of a sudden, that crash occurred because that vehicle was operating outside of its operational domain. That operational domain has to be one in which you have an automated emergency braking system operating on your vehicle. And if you're operating in a domain where you've turned it off, my goodness, of course you're not going to be safe. So in a sense, the tying of the domain with the safety aspect is absolutely key. I think the only other comment let me just make one more and then please.
Sure.
The only other comment I'd like to make is I think there's also a role here of Wall Street on top of all of this that I think needs to be, I don't know how it's implemented or out there. In a sense, Wall Street may end up being the ultimate enforcer of safety, simply because, as I think I started mentioning, if these aren't safe, they're worth nothing. And so all these companies are out there with their particular valuations. And if they have a substantial valuation, that valuation, that ranch is on the table. And if they're not safe, they lose the ranch. And so somehow or as part of all this, maybe the biggest enforcer of safety on all this in the end, especially in the beginning, when we don't know what we don't know, may in fact be Wall Street. So anyway, I just throw that out as another thought on top of, the very good work that you've done here.
Sure. Thank you. So just to pick up on a few things that you had mentioned, you referred to the challenge of sometimes companies could game certain measurements. We did, in talking with people, tease out a variety of characteristics that one would desire from a measure, and we ended up collapsing them into four, that they should be valid, feasible, reliable, and we said non-manipulatable. But there was a...
Right. I love your non-manipulatable. I love it. I love it. Yes.
And, we heard lots of conversations about that, but we also, in making our distinction between pure development and what we've called demonstration, we wanted to make a contrast between those times when the people developing the AV really want to throw everything at it you know, they don't really want to break it in the most literal sense, but they want to see what can go wrong. And that is legitimately part of developing a computer-based system. But then you get to a point where you are, you know, closer to engaging the public and you know, looking into deployment, and then you need a different kind of measure that you ought to be able to stand by and ideally to share. And I think your last point on the investor community is very well taken, because it connects back to what I was saying about the maturing of the industry, which is not mature, but it is so much closer to having some kind of commercial offering that the stakes are obviously higher. You know, we talked about the difference in testing between whether the employees associated with a developer or the testing facilities might be exposed, as opposed to the general public, which didn't sign up to participate in an experiment. And those are very real differences. I think that there's also the question of what will happen with the insurance industry. And they are certainly looking at these issues, along with the expectation that the ownership model is likely to shift more towards fleet ownership, a service provider offering access to the vehicles, as opposed to today's expectation of a lot of retail individual consumer ownership. And that will affect...
Well, that's somebody else's expectation than my expectation. I don't think there's a consumer... I'm a fleet guy, so go ahead.
Yes. Yes. No, well, I think that there are many reasons with AVs to expect more fleet ownership.
Absolutely. And it probably has to do with safety. And in fact, you probably can't even ensure safety if a bunch of consumers own it, because who knows how in the heck they're maintaining it and whatever. And
exactly.
the provisions over top of that consumer ownership are going to be so onerous that consumer will say, why in heck should I buy it? So, yeah. But anyway, those have to do with the scenario, which is really key in all this. Okay, and I think that you know, putting together what you proposed in here, the scenario along with the perception of safety, and making sure that one is clear in the coupling of those, really does a lot to advance the industry.
If I can chime in here, it sounds like there may be a real need for an education process for not only car makers but really consumers here.
You know, the idea that in addition to the abstract kind of education, which is what I suspect you were referring to help consumers who might read about AVs to get a sense of what do they look like, especially people who don't live in the Bay Area or Arizona where you can see them more often, and have more realistic expectations about how they would behave. I mean, we already have heard that there have been instances with some of the earlier testing of individuals deciding to challenge these vehicles, you know, run out in front because you know they're supposed to stop. And I do wonder whether everybody understands that even if these vehicles can stop, you know, they're not going to defy the law of physics. And, you know, there may be a stopping distance and it may be too small.
That also, and there needs to be an enormous educational campaign done with respect to respecting these vehicles, and because, you know, I can go out on the New Jersey Turnpike and go stand in the middle of the lane and bring the whole thing to close, okay, and cause an enormous whatever. But in a sense, one has to be able to do that. So there's an enormous education campaign that has to do with both providing information to the public that makes sense to the public, that they can understand, that is not you know, the Sunday supplement stuff that is so pervasive right now with respect to this technology.
I suspect most people, if you brought it up, would envision the ability to buy a car that drives itself. And that really is not what at least Alan's vision is here.
Yeah, it's not. And of course, if you look at what Tesla is now saying with respect to its next release of autopilot, I mean, I'm one isn't even sure whether it's Tesla or Tesla enthusiasts that are out there doing it. But the implication that it is a self-driving vehicle, or a driverless vehicle, I shouldn't say, my goodness, a driverless vehicle, it's just not there. It's not even close. It can't do it. It can't take you from the watering hole to your bedroom if you've had too many. And one shouldn't even be thinking about suggesting that. There's a lot of information that needs to be put out there to stop all this disinformation that's out there.
The other aspect is the challenge of conveying risk, and we talk at the end of the report about how, on the one hand, there certainly is literature on risk communications, and on the other hand, it remains a work in progress, that it's really hard to get people to understand all manner of risk. And we're just going to add this into the already imperfect understanding of the risks of flying, the risks of driving conventional cars, and so on. So I know enough about human-computer interaction to know that the answer is not going to be telling the public so much that the public will adapt its behavior. The burden remains on the developers and operators of these new vehicles to adapt to what we understand about the range of ordinary human behavior.
Maybe a quick comment, Marjorie, about where you go from here, and is there more that you're working on following on to this?
Well, we're at the moment where we're waiting to see what kind of responses we have. I know that one of my colleagues is likely to be talking with a technical group about our roadmanship idea. And I should mention that in connection with this colleague, one of the different things that we did in this report is that we combined a public health perspective with an engineering perspective. We brought both of those perspectives to bear in talking about measurement. So I do hope that we can share these ideas in different venues that are concerned about both measurement and also about safety policy. So it's my hope that there will be a series of conversations over the next few months, just to make sure people are aware, to get the feedback and to see where we go.
The roadmanship thing is really, our concept is really good. It probably, of course, needs to have public safety involved, and needs to have the broader transportation community involved. For years, I've been talking about truth in transportation. You know, we have speed limits out here. And the speed limits really are almost misinformation, because that's not the way the behavior is out there, and it's not even the way the enforcement is. You're either given 9 over, 4 over, 14 over, or whatever, and so we need to come to grips with that. Is it a limit or is it not a limit? Is 9 over the limit? What is it? Just because human behavior is always, trying to find the edge of the cage and stretch things. Well, what are the expectations? Are the expectations that you come to a complete stop at a stop sign? Or do you just have to check out to make sure there's nobody coming and therefore you can roll through? And all these things, and so the expectations of the behaviors that are then programmed into these things, which are really equally safe, really have to then deal with the public acceptance, both on the public side and on the public safety, on the enforcement side. So, you know, how you deal with all that, enormous issue, I think.
Well, we have.
Right, and that will connect with the infrastructure evolving as well.
Yes.
We have some other quick headlines to get to from the Smart Driving Car newsletter, Alan. First off, the CEO of Waymo, John Krafcik, this week announced the company's self-driving vehicles have now crossed 10 million miles driven on public roads.
Look at that. We now have a measure that tells us that it's safe. It is an impressive number. The question is, what were the miles? And if the miles are accumulated by driving over the same roads in the same conditions in Phoenix, Arizona, or Chandler, Arizona, okay, great. I mean, within that domain, absolutely. What the implications are here in Central Jersey to go between Trenton and Robbinsville on our conditions, maybe not so much. But it is an accomplishment. We've just been talking about trying to have the right measures, but it is an accomplishment.
Another headline, Consumer Reports says Cadillac tops Tesla in the organization's first ranking of automated driving systems.
There you go. We have some other measures out there that are going to tell us what we should be buying. And it's interesting within that is when they do the ranking, when they put together the apples with the oranges and the bananas to come up with pairs so that they can rank order them and find out what the top pair is. They're taking two measures. One is the supposed safety of the system or performance of the system safely, and the other one has to do with whether or not it's watching over you and how well it keeps you from misbehaving. And so they have a weight on the misbehaving apple to put it together with how well it goes around corners and stays in the lane and doesn't crash into the things in front of you and puts then coefficients in front of those to come up then to rank them. So the implication of it is if you're going to misbehave in your car, you should buy a Cadillac. If you're not going to misbehave and you want one that will really work and safely and you won't misbehave, you should buy a Tesla. But anyway, there it is.
In the newsletter, though, you seem pretty surprised that they didn't test the automatic emergency braking systems.
Well, they did. And, you know, that continues to be, at least is what I say, the Achilles heel of those systems. I don't know any details of what Waymo has on their system, but I bet they have an automated emergency braking system that works in all of the domains in which they operate. I can't imagine they've gone out there and done 10 million miles in whatever domains that they've done those domains and not had an automated emergency braking system that works. The problem is that it seems like a lot of other folks don't. And that is not a simple problem here because the false alarm rate associated with having a fixed object appear in front of you at higher speeds is a non-trivial process. And of course, what we have from history with respect to Tesla is, at least in the past, their automated emergency braking system didn't work. It didn't work in Florida. It didn't work in the crash with the barrier, the end of the barrier in California, or the crashes with respect to the fire trucks. And if you look at the IIHS reports, they only test those things up to 31 miles an hour. And if the design domain of where these are going to operate is 31 miles an hour and under, great. But the Uber car in Arizona was going 40. So anyway, yes, whatever.
Well, Tesla has put out a third quarter vehicle safety report and says it will publicly release accident figures on a quarterly basis. And the report indicates that there are significantly fewer accidents when autopilot is engaged.
Again, that's another measure. And look, we've been discussing, you know, single measures or whatever this. It is a number that one should maybe pay some attention to. Why? Because maybe there is not a bias between the operating environments of Teslas when you have autopilot on as opposed to when you have autopilot off. Although one might be able to argue that, in fact, those are biased samples, because where you have autopilot off, it may be much tougher driving conditions because autopilot can't handle it. And, in fact, autopilot is only operating in places where it's trivial or it's more simple, and therefore the probability of accident, blah, 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 is much less. So the fact that when autopilot is on, there are many fewer crashes than when autopilot is off has to be looked at in terms of the details. If, in fact, the mileage, the roads driven and the environments and the domains that those operated in are essentially the same, then those are really important numbers. If they're different, then one has to really look at what is the differences in the domains and to see whether or not one can reach any conclusions with that. But, you know, that's again, as with most things, it's the details or it's the terms and conditions that make the big
great
difference.
Perspective, Alan.
And the comparability. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Well, the Department of Transportation, here's some good news, has come out with figures indicating that motor vehicle fatalities last year decreased 1.8%, and that followed 2 years of increases. So I guess we'll take it.
Yeah, it's some good news, and you put it in there appropriately, Fred, that it follows a number of years of increases. And so if we look at the low point, I think the low point is 2011. You know, where we are versus 2011 is not all that good. And of course, we know why the reasons are, at least most people, I guess, sort of assume they know. It's because of all the distractions that are in the car. I mean, you know, everybody's texting and it's a real bad disease. And I think that's why one has to maybe back off on these safety measures and really do the safe car approach, the safe driving car approach that you know we've been talking about for so long. That in fact a lot of these safety things should be in the vehicle and just overseeing what we're doing. And if we start getting ourselves into trouble, should kick in there and keep us from crashing. And of course, as we've talked about, that starts with the automated emergency braking system. Those things should be in all cars that are sold, whether we take our hands off the wheel or don't take our hands off the wheel. And they should work. And just because the industry has said to buy 20 whatever, they're going to put these things in all cars. We need them to put those in all cars and have them work. And the ones that they're putting in the cars right now, sure, they work up to maybe 31 miles an hour. But many people are driving much faster than 31 miles an hour. And therefore, the industry needs to step up and improve their accuracy.
Finally, Lyft has hired former Obama Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox to lead policy and advise its founders. Good move here.
Of course, I think the one thing that Secretary Fox did is he got the federal DOT from just focusing on connected vehicles to focusing on automated vehicles. which is of course where the focus should be. I mean, of course we'll do connections, but you know, the connections don't do us much good until a large percentage of the vehicles are connected. And what do we do until then? And so, and the thought that in fact, you know, some whatever government policy, government regulation or whatever is going to get vehicles connected anytime soon is, well, I don't know, maybe, but I'm not banking on it. So I think that's a good fit. I think the focus with Lyft needs to be, you know, originally they weren't just ride hail. People called them a ride sharing company. The problem is they don't share any rides. They've lost their way in terms of really wanting to sharing rides and being in a Lyft in the backseat of a Lyft. With a Lyft driver is not sharing a ride. Those two people in California shouldn't have access to the high occupancy lanes. There's one vehicle and one ride. That's not reducing congestion, which is, I think, supposedly, at least at one point, was the reason why those things were put in there, was to relieve congestion, to sort of get people who are leaving a car at home by riding together to then have some benefit for leaving the car at home. And so I hope that he moves them again in that direction of ride sharing, because in the end, ride sharing is it's a solution to energy, to pollution, to congestion, to affordability, to but unfortunately, we have to ride with somebody, and some people suggest that we didn't come out of the womb that way. But I don't believe that. I think it's Madison Avenue that's in the process of making sure that we go to the dealership and buy our private vehicle. It told us how much, you know, privacy is worth and whatever. So I don't know.
Well, that is it for this edition. We want to thank Marjorie Blumenthal from RAND for being with us. Thank you again, Marjorie.
My pleasure.
Marjorie, so nice to have you.
It was fun. Marjorie. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you. And have a great weekend. We have beautiful fall weather here in the Northeast. How is it in California?
I'm actually in D.C., so
you're in D.C.,
so you're having
great weather too, huh?
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. Wonderful. So that's great. I don't know why I thought you were in California. Well, sorry about that. Whatever.
That's all right.
Anyway.
You can find us at smartdrivingcar.com on SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, Spreaker, and your Amazon Alexa. I'm Fred Fishkin along with Alan Kornhauser. Thank you for listening.
And now, an ad from Dad.
All right, save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive. Can I take these off? All right. What is this? This looks good. Wow. That's well made. Where did you get this? I'm talking to you, with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.